Welcome to On Mic, conversations from Northgate Hall, home of the University of California, Berkeley's Graduate School of Journalism. I'm Ed Wasserman, Dean of the School. As one of the nation's top journalism programs, we regularly invite the world's best reporters, writers, and documentarians to talk about the stories behind their stories. This time, we'll hear from Michael Barbaro, host of the Daily podcast produced by the New York Times.
I think video will always be the most powerful medium in an urgent news moment. I mean, there's nothing like seeing a natural disaster unfold on screen or anything, but I think the reflection and the depth of feeling and understanding come when it's just you and your brain processing the sound of it.
Michael Barbaro got his start in audio as a politics reporter covering the 2016 presidential campaign. The J School invited Barbaro to talk with veteran producer and J School audio instructor Ben Manila about the Daily's success, its unique approach to narrative news, and taking chances throughout his career. It's On Mic, Ben Manila in conversation with Michael Barbaro.
My mom subscribed to the New York Times. My dad, who's more of a Fox News watcher, has never really adapted to the fact that I worked at the New York Times. And that he even subscribed to it. The only columnist he likes to read and knows by name is my best friend growing up, Ross Douthat, who I've known since we were in middle school. And he'll say to me, you know, I read Ross. Ross was good. Not Maureen, not Tom, not Krugman, not any of those guys. So that's not for him. But I started working at very small newspapers and through internships, bigger newspapers, the Miami Herald. I was very lucky to get a coveted internship at the Washington Post one summer when I was a student in college. And that was very important because I became a business reporter, which was, I think, one of the best decisions I ever made. When I got an internship at the Washington Post, and they came back to me and said, would you be a business reporter on the business desk of the Washington Post? I panicked. I didn't want that job. I wanted to be a Metro reporter. I wanted to be a City Hall reporter. I wanted to cover politics. I thought that was where the action was. And I had gone to college, although he was much older, with David Leonhard, who's another columnist at the Times. And he was then a business reporter at the Times. And even though I was at the Washington Post, or thought I might be, anxiously, I called him and he said, no, you should definitely be a business reporter because you will learn how to think about business the way it's supposed to be, which is not as a business at all, but just as great stories. And that's really the secret of great business reporting. It's not about numbers and income statements and all that kind of stuff. And he was right, because when I got to the Washington Post, the big story going on then was Walmart, which it would be for the next 5 years, trying to come to Washington. So I ended up covering that story for the Washington Post. And it's a great example of kind of taking chances, which I think is a bit of a theme of my career. I mean, taking an internship at the Washington Post isn't the world's biggest chance, but not necessarily doing the thing you want to do, but doing the thing that's gonna get you to the thing you wanna do. So Walmart, as I said, was a story that was exploding. Lots of things were happening in Washington because union groups were fighting Walmart and they were sitting there and they started needing a place to leak the documents that they were getting from Walmart workers who weren't happy at Walmart, and I was right there, and I got those documents. And so we were breaking a series of big stories about what was going on inside Walmart, and that's how I got the attention of the New York Times. And in 2005, I was able to take the retail beat from the Washington Post to the New York Times and do that for several years until one day I woke up and said, I actually still want to be a political reporter. I still want to follow that path, even though I'd taken, I guess, a five-year diversion. And I started covering New York City politics, Michael Bloomberg, who, as you may or may not remember, in 2008 was supposed to be done with the mayoralty, but decided to change the law so that he could seek a third term. So that's what I ended up covering there. And on it spiraled until the political hierarchy of the New York Times is first you cover mayor's races, then if you're good, if you're lucky, you can cover a governor's race, and then eventually a presidential campaign. And the first presidential campaign that I covered was Mitt Romney running in 2012. And we didn't know how good we had it, how civil politics could be, the 2012 campaign between Barack Obama and Mitt Romney. And that was my introduction to national politics. And when you do one campaign, you're expected to do another campaign. And so in 2016, I end up in Donald Trump's office talking about Twitter. Campaigns had changed. And it was around then, this is the part where I get into audio, if you're following, that the New York Times decided it wanted to start seriously thinking about audio. And it hired a very talented woman from WBUR in Boston named Lisa Tobin. She came to the Times and had to make a decision about what the Times should sound like. And with 3 months left in the general election of the 2016 campaign, she decided to create a political podcast, and it would go on to be called The Run-Up. And she needed a host. And this is another interesting example about taking risks. One of my best friends in the newsroom is named Nick Confessori. If you ever watch Morning Joe or if you listen to watch political coverage, he's on a lot. And he got a call saying, do you want to host a political podcast that the New York Times is going to do? And he was staying in the next hotel room at the Democratic Convention in 2016 in Philadelphia. And he answered the phone and he said, no, I don't want to host a podcast. I don't. It's not going to fit my lifestyle and my vision of my career. And you know, I don't want to do that. But he had the foresight to call me in the next room over. And he said, you know, I think you're probably the next person in line to get this call. I'm second best, apparently. And the phone rings in my room after we get off the phone. And the editors say, Michael, the Times is launching a political podcast. You're the first person we thought of. You're perfect for the job. Bullshit artists. And I had, in those 5 minutes, I had made up my mind that I was ready for something new and that this sounded really exciting. And so I said yes. And as they say, the rest is history. But that was the single best decision I ever made.
Well, let me just interrupt for a second about that history, because we have a lot of students here who are very interested in writing and long form writing and political writing and sort of mildly interested in audio and I think scared of it a little.
Yeah.
What was it like for you to go from the printed word to the ear?
Good question. Well, so I had a safety net, if I'm being honest, which is that we worked out a situation in which I would host this show, which was twice a week. And the way it was advertised, and this is, if you end up going into journalism, you'll all find this, your bosses will promise you that a job is a certain number of hours and it will absolutely fit into your lifestyle. And you can do all of it. You can do this and you can't. And the job will consume your life. And that's why you have to love it. So the advertisement was that you'll do the podcast twice a week and you'll also write. And I had to do both those things at the same time. So I didn't have to give up writing to do the daily. I actually could kind of toggle between the two. But what I immediately found about doing audio was that the feedback that we got, both the volume and the quality of it, was so much higher than for the printed word. Mm. And we're all ultimately affirmation people. Fill in the blank. Yeah. We all want to be loved, but we also want to have impact. And audio, I'd never experienced anything in journalism that was so immediately having an impact as when we did the run-up. We would get voluminous emails and social media kind of interactions that suggested that the show was reaching people on a deeper level. And I instantly sort of understood it. And we were creating an intimate family on the show. I mean, if you remember the 2016 campaign, there were some people whose names you'll remember very well. There was Maggie Haberman. There was Glenn Thrush. There was a series of other characters. And a little bit like Matt, Katie, and Al, like we started to create a family on the show. And the Times started to think about it differently than I think it anticipated, because I think most journalists view new mediums as a little bit of a nuisance. Oh, okay, what's the latest thing you want me to do? Like put a camera on my head and you want me to take a video, you know, camera with me and this, that, and the other. But audio, just something about the moment just worked. And the audience started to grow pretty quickly on the run-up. And it became a template for what came next, which was really thoughtful, thematic approaches to the news. And in the case of the run-up, we would often pick a theme, like truth or something, and we could do one or two or three segments explorations of that. So as you can imagine, if you listen to shows like This American Life, like that's not all that original. But we were doing it with politics, and we were doing it twice a week, and we were doing it with the kind of unique authority of Times reporters and their access, right? So it wasn't kind of like way up in the sky storytelling. It was very grounded in their data, in the day-to-day reporting of Times reporters. And at the end of the campaign, despite the strong impression that we contributed to, that that Hillary Clinton was going to win, Donald Trump prevailed. And that very much becomes decisive in the creation of The Daily. I'm not embarrassed to say that I don't know that The Daily would exist if Donald Trump hadn't won, because there was the run-up had run out of run-up. You know, there was not much more to say. We stuck around till the inauguration, and we put our heads together and we said, we're having a big impact. Times reporters love coming on the show. It's amplifying and transforming the storytelling they do. The audience likes it. What's the next phase of this? And we thought about the election and the inauguration of Donald Trump, and we said, you know, we think there's enough to sustain a daily version of this. We think the newsroom is ready for it. We think maybe the culture is ready for it. The big question was like, would the story sustain a daily show? Would there be enough news, enough tension, enough calamity, enough whatever? You're just like enough stuff. And the answer is pretty clear that like that there was. And so another wager and bet was made that the world wanted a daily on-demand podcast. And here I feel it's necessary to tell people, of course, like all things considered, Morning Edition, like the idea of a daily news show is not entirely new. What was new, and I think was Lisa Tobin's genius, was the idea of a digital on-demand show, by which I mean you hit play on your phone, it's in a feed, and we're going to somehow habituate you to that, and we're going to assume that you're going to listen the whole way through because you're not in your car listening to a little bit of it and picking up and letting go, and that the habit that people were starting to develop of podcasts could actually be a daily habit, which didn't exist at that moment. And what was necessary to make that happen were a few things. One was a very serious platform by which you could tell the world you existed. We had that, the New York Times. The second thing you needed was you need to immediately kind of cast off the indulgent length of most podcasts, 45 minutes to an hour. Nobody has that kind of time every day, and you would just lose people. So we initially said we were going to be a 15-minute podcast, which we're not, but that was the idea. We were going to be 15 to 20 minutes. And the third thing that we really needed was kind of constancy we decided of a single host that would have a really intimate bond rather than a giant rotating cast of characters. And we hoped that the host would have that connection. And so we launched The Daily on February 1st of 2016, which is the night that Neil Gorsuch was nominated for the Supreme Court. Now, I was still extremely rusty. I mean, the run-up was fine, and it was successful insofar as, you know, a political podcast could be, but I still did not know what I was doing. And The Daily was starting to hire these very seasoned, serious producers. And I want to play you a clip, and I'm going to warn you that it contains profanity at the end, of the first night of the producers trying to train me to say the date of the show, which is, if you guys don't listen to The Daily, if you do this show, so we say, like, from The New York Times, I'm Michael Barbaro, this is The Daily, today, we give you a summary of the show, we call it the billboard, we agonize over every word, and then I say at the end, you know, it's Friday, September 21st. And so I'm gonna play you this is the first clip of what that first night was like. It's Wednesday, February 1st.
It's Wednesday, February 1st.
It's Wednesday, February 1st.
It's Wednesday, February
1st. Yeah.
What's the matter? I'm not hitting Wednesday, right? I know, these directions are not meaning a whole lot to me. It's Wednesday. It's Wednesday, February 1st.
There you go. That's a wrap.
All right. All right, now we got to fucking narrate. It's 8 p.m. on Tuesday night. So it was a huge adjustment to every day being in the studio. At the beginning until, you know, that was probably 2 in the morning. I think there's a little bit of a misunderstanding that we make the show in the morning. We make the show the day before.
Right.
Oh, almost always. But we, for the first year of the show, we accidentally made the show every morning because we would be up until 2 or 3 or 4 in the morning recording. Because the producers are perfectionists, and it's what makes The Daily so extraordinary. And I am not an experienced audio person, and so there's a natural tension there. And it means that that I have to you know, I had to learn. I'll just give you the example. This is a new version of my voice than existed.
That's where I was going to go next. I was going to ask you, one of the things that's so distinct about the program
is
the urgency in your voice.
Yeah, and the gravity.
And the gravity, yeah. And so where'd you get that?
So I didn't possess this voice right away. I have a kind of an audio, I have a repubescence that occurred in audio. And what happened was that the producers of the show, when we started, said, you know, you're just not sounding hosty, you know, and not even in like in an Ira Glass or, you know, kind of NPR kind of way. Like you're not going deep enough into the place you need to go. And I mean, how do you even teach someone that? But they did. And they had a signal they would use with they'd put two fingers together and they'd be like, go down. And so I would like, and I would do that with them. And over time, I guess I like discovered my diaphragm and I sort of summoned that voice. And the creepy, weird thing about it is that it's now my voice. And I discovered along the way, I would be having a casual conversation, like, yeah, Ben, what are you thinking? And it would be like, oh shit, that's my voice now. And this old kind of like, you know, younger, higher pitched version of myself just went away. And I don't know how that happened. So we're off to the races, we're making the show. And so now I want to kind of explain what the producers, and it's extremely producer driven. I think I really like to explain to people how the show works and who makes it work. And who makes it work are 10 to 11 producers whose names you hear on Friday afternoon or morning at the end of the show. And The Daily is as producer driven a show as you will ever hear, because what the essential dynamic of The Daily is that we take 1,100 reporters who wake up every morning thinking about the oldest school way to tell a story, which is news, nut graph, quotes, context, on and on and on until the least important stuff is at the bottom. You all know this, the inverted pyramid of journalism. And then a bunch of narrative producers on The Daily who want to flip that inside out and turn it upside down, and who never want the news to be at the beginning of the show, because they really want you to earn the news. I mean, the fundamental concept of the Daily is narrative news. It's kind of what we call ourselves. And Annie Brown, who was going to be here today, likes to say that really what happens in The Daily is you have to find the story of the news, the narrative thread. So if you think about all the predecessors to which we owe so much gratitude, it is This American Life. It shows that exist to tell long, thoughtful, chronological stories with big ideas landed at the end. And I think what's special about The Daily is that the producers imagined applying that to the news every single day and never starting just with the news. Because, I mean, how would we fill 20 minutes of a show with just the news analyzed?
And it's wonderful the way it's all interwoven, mm-hmm. and how they are not scared to just jump in and throw something that's seemingly random, but obviously not random.
Cold opens. I mean, we have a lot of tricks up our sleeve, but we often will start people off in a seemingly confusing place on the show. And the biggest debates we have on the show are where to start a story. And we'll spend hours and hours in a room together every morning, chewing over, once we decide what story we want to do, the best way to tell that story and where to start. And it's kind of a never-ending debate. And what's challenging about The Daily is that I don't narrate stories. It's all done through question and answer with a reporter, for the most part, or a guest from the real world that we have, or a lawmaker. And so for the first couple of weeks and months of the show, reporters would come into the studio and we would try to explain to them what we were doing. We're going to tell a narrative version of a story where there's a lot of suspense, we're holding things back, we don't want to tell everything right away. And we'd ask them a question and they would vomit out the story. And they would just, and then we'd have to, you know, do that thing that people do when they like each other and they don't want to be mean. Just say, like, that was so good. That was so good.
Now do it again.
Now, we're just going to do the whole thing all over again, not like that. And what shocked the hell out of me was how open-minded Times reporters were to this form, and how eager they were to flex muscles they didn't even know they had and tell stories differently. And that's partly because of the moment we're in. It's partly because of the story we were telling, which for the most part was just so, I mean, mind-blowing, the beginning of the Trump presidency, the Muslim ban, the crackdown on undocumented immigration, the hiring and firing of people like Michael Flynn, and on, the Russia investigation. It was so complicated that we needed to find compelling ways to tell it. And so one of the first examples of, that I want to play a clip from, I think represented this, kind of what was distinct about the way we were going to tell stories, was a breaking news story around James Comey and Donald Trump. And the guest is, you know his name, is Michael Schmidt, who's probably won more Pulitzer Prizes in 1 year than most people can win in a lifetime. So I'm going to play you this clip. This was about 3 months into the show.
Hey.
Hey.
Sorry. So I got the folks here at Kinko's to let me use the phone.
How did you do that?
I told them I needed to call the office. But the problem is I got my laptop on the other side of Kinko's here. I'm afraid some Russian spy is going to take it, so I got to keep my eyes on it.
Michael Schmidt called us from the only landline he could find. So, Mike, what did you find?
So Comey gets fired on Tuesday. I go in the office 7 a.m. on Wednesday morning. We're just trying to figure out what the heck happened and start making some calls early.
On and on it goes. And what ends up unfurling is Mike Schmidt telling a very kind of intriguing, mysterious story of how he gets to the information, which comes very late in the episode, that James Comey is in the White House with President Trump. They're having dinner. And President Trump turns to him, you all know the story now, by now, and says, "Do I have your loyalty?" James Comey says back, "Well, you have my admiration." You have, and then they go back and forth and back and forth until he says, he comes up with some clever dodge. And so immediately a couple things stand out about that clip and I think represent what's distinct about The Daily, which is that in print that day, the story was just, you know, was the loyalty oath story. And which came out after James Comey had been fired. In audio form with Mike, there are all these characters that are developing. And just to give you a few examples, there's Mike, the kind of intrepid, wisecracking, grizzled reporter, even though he's younger than me. He has that aura. There's James Comey, who ends up, you know, being the sort of like virtuous lawman. There's the kind of Don Corleone-esque Donald Trump character who asks for his loyalty in the room. And there's this guy at Kinko's by the end of the episode who gives the phone over. And at the end of the episode, Mike mentions his name. He's like, you know, James here at Kinko's really wants the phone back. And so one of the things that happened with that episode immediately is we recognized the power of being transparent with the listeners about things that generally, you know,
you cut that out immediately.
You just cut it. Yeah. And also it's pretty shitty phone line quality. But producers at The Daily who come from places like All Things Considered and Public Radio will tell you that we run episodes with audio quality that would have immediately been rejected from NPR. But there's something so authentic about it. He's in a Kinko's. It's amazing. I mean, if you sent I don't want to get too technically audio, if you sent a professional audio syncer with a microphone to Kinko's, all that stuff goes out the window. And yes, you get high quality audio, but you sort of lose all this sort of texture. And I think what becomes so fun about an episode like this, and this was a breakthrough episode for us, people remembered it and talked about it a lot, was that all these raw elements were kept. And that the story unfolded in this kind of interesting, mysterious way. Why is Mike in a Kinko's? Where is this Kinko's? Who is this guy? And he is as much a character in the story as James Comey and Donald Trump. And so that's what we talk about when we talk about kind of narrative news. And Mike Schmidt has now become such a beloved character on The Daily that we don't even have to pitch. We don't even have to ask him to come on anymore. He pitches us on stories. I don't know if you guys listened a couple days ago to Mike Schmidt interviewing Bob Woodward on The Daily, which was a really wonderful episode. And what a dream Mike is now that he calls us up and says, "I think you should interview Bob Woodward, and I think I should do it." not you, Michael. You get to host plenty. And that, as I was telling you on the car right over here, like, that is a dream. I mean, I have now hosted seemingly 600 episodes of The Daily, and that was a dream. And it was these two reporters who really admire each other, and you could feel it that they have a relationship, and they do. And that was a wonderful episode. So I'm going to keep going and move along. And so this idea of narrative news is pretty simple. as I began to talk about, it's applying the principles of narrative form, which is really about pacing, where you start the story, how slowly you let the story unfold. A lot of suspense. It's what we don't tell you at the beginning, but we do tell you at the end. It's really letting characters like a Mike Schmidt, like a James Comey, really come through. And ultimately, it's about some idea. We never want to just tell you what happened. We really want to step back and give you some kind of idea. And I want to use one more example of how we tell a story that I'm particularly proud of, and it involves an interview with somebody who's not in the New York Times, but who we found after a mass shooting. So you all remember the terrible Las Vegas mass shooting, where more than 50 people were killed. And this had been our fourth or fifth mass shooting since the Daily started. I mean, it's just the most horrible, macabre kind of routine of American life at this point, that there are mass shootings. And we all looked at each other, as we do in these morning meetings where we start to process how we're going to approach a story, and we toss out the first 10 ideas. I mean, it's just remarkable how many B ideas we just throw away. What about this person? What about that? What if we talk to this reporter about? No. And we are a professional, like, story trashing machine. And eventually, a producer says, I've always wanted to hear. Oh, yeah, if I give this away, is this going to be a problem? Yeah, I'm going to do it. I've always wanted to hear from the owner of a gun store who sold a gun in a mass shooting. The minute it was said, I was like, of course you do. And the, okay, first of all, how do you do that? How do you find that? It feels like a bit of a needle in the haystack. A producer named Ike Srikantharaja, he started making calls, and he found someone, and Ike is incredibly disarming. He pre-interviewed this man, but not too much, which is also kind of key. Just a brief conversation. You know, we want to have an open-minded conversation with you. We're going to call you in an hour. Can you just confirm a couple things? We set it up. And we then move into the phase of the day that is several hours, which is we begin scripting. And this is where I think the idea of narrative news and what makes The Daily so unique is really going to become clear. So on October 4th, this is the way we end up approaching it. And what I want to show you is, I'm going to tease it and then come back, is the inside of a Daily Google Doc. The Daily exists as a production in a Google Doc every day. And you guys all use Google Docs, I assume. Mm-hmm. We use them exclusively. If there's no Google Doc service, we don't make the show. And reason we use Google Docs is not just because it's a pretty great technology, it's because I don't come from audio. Anyone who's ever worked in public radio knows that the way that things work in a studio is there's a button you can press, and into someone's ear or in the room will come a producer talking. But because I don't come from audio, and the idea of someone talking to me is dreadful in my ear or anyplace else, we created a weird system around the weird host where everything is done in Google Docs. So in real time, questions are being changed and rearranged in a Google Doc, and it doesn't distract me, and that's our system. And if you've ever wondered why the host of The Daily can sometimes have a halting pause in the middle of a question, it's because sometimes the word has not yet been written. let me dramatically explain. So Ben, when did you realize that the question was not yet written? And that's not really something that happens that often because it's incredibly collaborative. I'm in the document, they're in the document, but that happens. So watch for those pauses. And so the way we approach this interview is that we are not going to ask this guy, John Markell, about selling a gun to a mass shooter. Because what could be more defensive, creating, and kind of off-putting to someone than to be the subject of the most predictable line of questioning about their role in a terrible, terrible situation? So the way we structure this interview is like this. It starts off kind of an interesting cold open. You don't know who this guy is. You don't even know why we're talking to him yet. And the first question is, can you tell me about your store? And why don't we play this clip, and you can kind of see how it unfolds. He's a real character.
Hello, and I know why you're calling.
Hey, is this John?
Yeah.
Hey, it's Michael Barbaro from the New York Times.
Oh, jeez. Oh, so bad.
About
your store? Maybe just describe it to me.
You're talking about the gun shop?
Yeah.
We already had a number of shops in the area, so I decided I didn't want to sell the same thing they did, which was all hunting equipment. And so I started out by selling tactical equipment, like AR-15s or long-range rifles.
So that's how the conversation begins. And I think we'll actually get to the clip that I was going to have you play. But the conversation begins just about, like, tell me why it is you set up your store where it was. Tell me what you sell. And the reason he sells AR-15s, which, of course, are the most commonly used guns in mass shootings, was not because he had a particular affinity for it. It's because the gun store down the street sold different guns, and he wanted to distinguish himself. And on we go. And we start having a more targeted, I didn't mean that in a punny way, we start having a more refined, focused discussion about how many guns you sell, what kinds of guns most people come in for. And I think because we structure it this way, and you're a little confused in the beginning, and you're talking to a real human being, and it's about how he made decisions in his career, it's very, very respectful that when we get to the tougher questions, the kind of turns, the hard ones about, you know, can you tell me about a particular moment that happened, which was the selling of a gun in a mass shooting, he's not on guard. His defenses are down, and he's ready to have a real conversation. I think if we play this clip, when did you first hear about the shooting, the Virginia Tech shooting?
Well, it happened on a Monday. Well, you got to understand, I was listening from the whole thing, the news from the very beginning. One person was killed in the dorm. Then there's two. And then mm-hmm. a long, long gap, or seemed like it was a long gap. And then we hear there's 10. There's 15. It just kept going up and up. And I kept thinking, my God, it's got to stop. Mm. And I had to deal with the ATF immediately, Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. We didn't know it was us until ATF told us it was. I mean, it was breaking my heart. My daughter graduated from Tech in 1997.
Wow.
I mean, I can't believe it.
It sounds like it was painful for you to realize.
It was painful. It was terribly painful. I was hurt. You have no idea. I don't know. They think that because I have a gun shop, I've got a mean streak, and I want to see people use it. I do want to see people use it to kill animals for eating. You don't kill if you don't eat it. And one shot, one kill. I gave up killing for food, even though I ate everything I killed. I gave up hunting because of an incident where I did not kill a deer on the first shot. It took two. And that poor deer had to suffer for 10 minutes. I didn't want that on my conscience at all.
So, I mean, there's like process all that, but one of the things that sat with me for so long was that a guy who can sell AR-15s to teenagers who use them in mass shootings can also express extraordinary sympathy for a deer who was shot twice. I mean, people are so fucking complicated. Mm-hmm. And, but also he's got a daughter who went to Virginia Tech. And by the end of the interview, one of the things he says that really that has stayed with me since was, we said, how did you feel after the shooting? And he said, I feel the same way you do. I just feel like completely broken by it. And yet he sold the gun, and he continues to sell those guns. And gun sales, he told us, went up after the shooting in his store. So think about that complicated math. He sells a gun, it gets used in a shooting. Some part of him dies in the process because he's so torn up about it. And yet as a result of it, because as with after every mass shooting, gun sales go up, his store benefits from that. So, and we processed all that. And I think because of the way we structured it, because the first question was, can you tell me about your store? Why did you do this? Why did you do that? Tell me about what it's like in the store. He just opened himself up in such an extraordinary way. One of the things he told us that we couldn't believe it told us was, he told us about a woman who walked into his store, bought a gun, and went out into the parking lot and committed suicide. And we processed all that. And I just don't think we could have ever had the kind of candor from him that we got if we'd started the interview the way everybody in TV and in some ways in print starts interviews. And so this is, I think, the magic of kind of this approach to telling stories.
Is it completely scripted out at the very beginning?
Yes.
It is.
Yes,
okay.
It changes as any good Google document does. This was the script, and we were very faithful to it. And things changed towards the end as the conversation got more complicated. And I think Lisa Tobin, who was the producer of this segment, I think that last question was something she added at the end when it started to feel like we wanted to raise the stakes of things. I mean, you have to adapt to the interview. The worst interviews are the ones, and I've definitely done them, where you just stick to the script when the conversations get changing, and you don't respond to the ways in which people are surprising you, and you try to get to an idea you had at the end of the interview that they're not contributing to. And so, but this one worked. And, but yes, I guess it's a little bit more of our process. After this happens and the interview is finished, the producers will begin cutting it down. And Daily often have two producers working on the same segment, which is a little unusual. Two people might split the interview up. They'll take the first half, the second half, and begin cutting it, and then we'll put it together. And that's when we'll begin. If you listen to the Daily, we use a tremendous amount of external audio, news clips, original audio from the person speaking, President Trump, a protester.
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about, yeah.
All that's added in the early evening. And yes, it can replace my question. I mean, sometimes a piece of audio is just more powerful than the host talking. So that comes in. And sometimes a question I ask just doesn't make sense. So I will redo the question. We try to be pretty faithful to it. Try to sort of keep the integrity of the interview. But sometimes I just bungle a question, right? And it's confusing. And Daily guests, New York Times reporters, we will do retakes with them. You know, when you listen to a really beautiful New York Times Daily interview and you wonder, like, how is it a reporter just speaks so perfectly, narrates so beautifully? No one does. We try multiple takes of things sometimes. But with a person like John Markell, we don't ever do retakes. That's our system. If we're interviewing somebody who's not a Times reporter, you get one shot. And so that's why so much preparation goes into that interview.
Got it. I understand. So we're a little tight on time.
Yeah, now,
so I want to make sure that we can open up the floor. There's a question back there, Julie.
Hi, thank you so much for coming. It's really exciting.
It's so exciting to be here.
Yeah, to have you. I have two questions. One is, was there ever a story that you wished you could cover because so many things were happening you weren't able to? And two, do you need help this summer?
So I'm not in charge of hiring because I don't know enough about audio. So there are definitely people who, and I actually believe we have a fellowship program we're going to create for, I don't actually know if it's going to be seasonal or not, So we have a great hiring site on the Times in audio, so you should find that. To your first question, the stories that we wish we could do and we don't do enough of because of domestic news is international news. I mean, we have so many foreign correspondents. There are so many great stories to tell. We are agonized about how little we've covered China. There are 10 stories we want to do out of China about, its growing influence in the world, especially vis-a-vis, United States under President Trump. Retreating, it's time differences are hard. They can be prohibitive for us. We have to put out a show at 6 a.m. We get in the morning at 10, by which point it's 10 p.m. Am I correct me if I'm not? 12-hour time differences are incredibly difficult to deal with. So we have to make the show maybe 3 or 4 days ahead and on that, and then it might not be as newsy, and then news might overtake it. So yeah, our biggest regrets and our greatest desire lies with doing more reporting abroad and especially in Asia.
So I know that at the Times, editorial and the news teams are like church and state and super separate. I feel like the Daily sometimes can put a reporter at least in a position where they're almost playing their hand a little bit as a reporter. So I'm just wondering how you all navigate that mm-hmm. situation. And then I have a sub question, which I'm less interested in, but while I have the mic, which is you often play this role of clarifying with the reporter. And how does that make you feel to kind of have to be like, so what you mean is.
Yeah. So what you're saying is I often repeat people's questions. well, I can tackle that first. I mean, that's a thing that the producers taught me as somebody who didn't come from an audio background, that we're asking people to listen to a 25-minute, sometimes 30-minute show in a car while they're doing dishes, while they're raising their families, while they're living life. And restatement is a pretty simple and user-friendly way to really, it's like the audio equivalent of just highlighting a passage. It's like, it's just restating it. And also, it generally prompts the reporter, the guest, to just amplify the point, deepen it, and so you don't miss it. And so sometimes in the document, in the Google Doc, at this point, it's all shorthand for us. It's like, why don't you restate that? Why don't you make sure we're understanding that correct? And obviously, we do it sometimes, and they say, I just said that. And then we cut that. Michael Schmidt has a very funny response to that sometimes, even though he knows it. So it's obviously, he's just making our lives difficult. But I'll say, so Mike, what you're saying is like, yeah. What do you want me to say? You want me to say you're a brilliant host? Matt Apuzzo also does. He's like, yes, brilliant host. Yes, that's what I meant. So that's the point of that. But your first question was about kind of church and state. So we have made a decision, which certain columnists of the paper have certainly taken note of, which is that we generally, for the first year and a half, 2 years, like, we have not had many, if any, opinion writers on. And when we have them on, we ask them to take off their opinion hat and put on their reporting hat. So for example, Nick Christoph's been on twice to talk about his deep understanding of North Korea. And he went to North Korea and he was rolling on his recorders. So I was like, well, we gotta have him on. And sometimes we'll just tell the listener, this is a columnist, you might anticipate a little more opinion. Sometimes we'll just cut the parts that are opinionated, or we'll continually remind them, like, we really don't want your opinion, we want your facts. Because one of the original premises of the show was that we had to be not bending over backwards, but we had to find a way after Trump's election to signal that we were going to be a show that was about generous listening, no opinions, and these really deep narrative approaches to telling stories. And if we screwed up even once or twice, and we signaled to listeners that we were opinionated, or that we were talking to a lot of people on the left but not on the right, that we thought that something essential was going to be lost in the show. And I think to a remarkable degree, we have succeeded in never seeming like the show you're going to expect us to be. We're based in New York. We're on the East Coast. We came from where we came from.
It's the New York Times.
It's the New York Times. And yet I think one of the highest pieces of praise we get is that we don't sound like a show made by an organization that you expect to sound a certain way, that we reach out to speak to people like John Markell and have these profoundly respectful conversations. And that was very much by design. It's not accidental. It's very easy for people to fall into bad habits and patterns, especially during 2.5 hour interviews, especially with someone like an opinion writer. So we work super, super hard to keep that up.
I'm sure some students would want to know, do you guys take pitches?
Do we take pitches from non-New York Times people?
From non-New York Times people.
Really, no. Because we just don't want for stories. I mean, we have 1,300 reporters. We can tap into the culture desk, the metro desk, the national desk, the business desk. We have too many stories, and they take so long to tell that we have to be really careful about what we bet on. You know, our nightmare is doing a long interview and not using it. You know, it's just this, putting out the show is such a monster every day. It's a really long day.
So you don't have any evergreen shows? You don't have any shows just sitting around waiting to pop in if something happens?
At most, at any time, we have two or three episodes that are kind of ready to go. We do not have a deep shelf. We are an operation that lives on a knife's edge. And we've had some really hairy moments. Where, you know, are we going to have a show tomorrow?
Like one, give me one.
Well, we had a really complicated thing happen, which is we did an interview after Hurricane Harvey where, and you never heard this interview, it never ran, we thought it was going to run, with a woman who lost her brother. And we called to speak to the mother. We're going to just tell the narrative story of someone losing someone in that storm. Her brother had been electrocuted in the strangest way possible. He had had surgery and he had a metal part in his leg, and he went to go rescue his sister's dog. And all of a sudden, he touched a metal post. There was electricity in the water. He was with a friend. He got electrocuted, and he had just enough life left in him to tell his friend to go away and not to touch him because he would get electrocuted. And we called to speak to the mother who had done an interview with the Times, and the sister answered, the sister whose dog he went to rescue. And we interviewed her. She just stayed on the phone. We interviewed for about an hour. And I don't think we realized until afterward that she had been sobbing almost the entire time, and we were crying too. And when the episode was done at around 2 a.m, the executive producer of the show made a really tough call. She said, this is this is too much. This is too raw. It's going to be 6 a.m. and this is too much suffering, too much pain, too unprocessed. And it was 2:30 a.m. And we ended up doing something really creative and weird, which was a colleague of ours, Andy Brown, had created a show recently called Change Agent, a podcast. And we slipped it in. It was a Friday of a holiday weekend. And it was a little bit of a, it wasn't exactly a fib, but it was like, we want to tell you about a brand new show coming right. Really. And that's what we did. And that was the closest we ever came to disaster.
I think this is more of a compliment, but just sort of piggyback on what you just said, I think you are so empathetic when you talk to people, and I just think it's such a strength as a journalist, and why the show is really so, so compelling. But I'm just wondering, and you kind of just gave an example of whether it's ever difficult to kind of keep yourself together.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, the people who work on The Daily are just, they're the most sensitive people I've ever met, like seismologically. Like, they just feel the world vibrations a little more deeply than most. And yeah, we have some really emotional moments. I mean, I think if you listen to The Daily long enough, if you've listened for a week or a month or 2 years since it started, like, you will have cried at different episodes. And to do those interviews is to be in tears during them. And then afterwards, in the making of them. And so one of the challenges is just making sure that we're not too depressing, and that we're not pulling too much at heartstrings. I mean, one of the most delicate things about being in the podcast world now is we have all these ways of enhancing emotion, scoring, music, pauses, tape, music especially. We just did an episode, Andy could, I think, ask people to listen to it, about a guy named Wayne Daly and his wife, Casey, who died in Hurricane Harvey. And, you know, the way that was done, I mean, I cried at the beginning of the first episode and the end of the second. Everybody cried at different places. But what are our obligations to just let the story be, and how much do we want to signal to people it's time to be emotional is a really tricky thing. Sometimes we hear from people that think we use too much music, not enough music. And we definitely look for a balance between news, what we call these more documentary-like stories, and the ones that draw out the most emotion, and we don't want to overdo any of it. And ultimately, we're a news show. We're a weird version of a news show that has to remember. I mean, the times that we're always looking for corrections and new courses and pulling ourselves back in and then letting ourselves go back out to sea a little bit are these emotional features. We think in some ways they're the heartbeat of the show, but they don't sustain the show, because we have to be able to touch back to what's happening in Washington, like, what is the news of the day, and then finding, you know, the day one of Kavanaugh for us is what happened, where do we, like, we got to tell that story. Day two is, what did Dianne Feinstein do, why did she do it this way? Day three, and we think about these as day, you know, 2 or 3 day stories, and we obsessively plan it, is day three is, can we find someone who went through something like this woman? And that's how we found Caitlin Flanagan. Mm-hmm. And I interviewed her in LA earlier in the week. And Annie Brown, this brilliant producer, read the piece, realized that the story was really about forgiveness, and this guy apologizing to Caitlin for sexually assaulting her, and that he had written in her yearbook. And this is brilliant producing, and you cannot overestimate how important it is. Caitlin said, Annie said to Caitlin on her way over to the studio, do you think you could bring that yearbook with you? And if Caitlin Flanagan had not brought in that yearbook to the studio, we would not have had the interview we had. There's so much planning that goes into thinking about, I mean, that's what you see here. There's so much planning that goes into these segments.
Can I just amplify what you're saying by pointing out that I believe that audio is the most emotional of the media.
Agreed.
That audio goes straight to the heart. And when you can tap into something like Caitlin's story, mm-hmm. or the Hurricane Harvey story, just the tears and the emotion, the excitement, whatever, come pretty naturally.
Yeah, I mean, there's nothing so powerful as the image you evoke in your mind rather than the one that's on the screen. I mean, I think video will always be the most powerful medium in an urgent news moment. I mean, there's nothing like seeing a natural disaster unfold on screen or anything, but I think the reflection and the depth of feeling and understanding come when it's like, it's just you and your brain processing the sound of it. I think that's right.
Wonderful way to end this. Ladies and gentlemen, let's hear it for Michael
Barbera
and The Daily.
We've been listening to Michael Barbaro in conversation with Ben Minella. This has been On Mic, a podcast presentation of the University of California, Berkeley's Graduate School of Journalism. Technical facilities for On Mic are underwritten by the Jonathan Logan Family Foundation. Our producer is Lee Mengistu. I'm Dean Ed Wasserman. Thanks for listening, and I hope you can join us next time.